Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Ari Ariel, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Hasia Diner about her new book, Roads Taken, The Great Jewish Migrations to the New World and the Peddlers Who Forged the Way. Professor Diner is the professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies and History at New York University and also the Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History. Hasia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. I wonder if we could begin by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I teach American Jewish history at New York University, and I do so as a Jewish historian and as an American historian, and so the two are completely tied up together. I have, until this book, written almost exclusively in American history, although not exclusively in Jewish history. And so I've always sort of challenged myself as an American Jewish historian to think about other aspects of American history, particularly American immigration and ethnic history. And so I did a book on Irish immigrant women in the 19th century. And I did another book on looking at three immigrant groups, Irish, Italians, and East European Jews in the context of foodways. And so it was always in this American context. And for this book, Roads Taken, I decided to stretch myself in another direction and to think about the Jewish migration to the United States in the context of the larger worldwide Jewish migration. So I see myself as an Americanist, as a Jewish historian. And I see this reflects my own kind of intellectual restlessness, and I always, whatever direction I'm going in, I kind of want to look in a slightly different perspective about it. And so I think over the course of my career, I've gotten a chance to do lots of different projects.
And so this is the first book that's really international in scope. That must have had some challenges to it.
Yes, because it is challenging first and foremost because I didn't know all these other histories, and so I really had to teach myself about, in a way, two different kinds of zones. And one is I had to figure out why this Jewish migration took place, and so I had to become pretty comfortable, pretty familiar with Jewish history, not just in Europe, but also the Ottoman Empire and North Africa, in that these Jewish peddlers were coming from those places as well. And while their numbers may not have been as great, they were still part of the great Jewish migration, and they were peddling as well. So I had to learn that. But then these peddlers, these young men, went to not just the United States, although it was certainly the most popular destination, and it was the one that about 85% went to, but they were also going to South Africa, to Canada, to the Caribbean, to Central America, to South America, to what don't seem to be New World destinations, but they were for the Jews, which is namely the British Isles, England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, as well as Sweden. And so I didn't know these. I mean, I guess I knew the Irish. But other than that, these were all brand new for me. And so it was one of the things I really loved about the project, was just sort of plunging into the histories of these places in this era in which the Jewish migration was taking place, and particularly thinking about the kinds of people to whom the Jewish peddlers sold, the kinds of people whom they would have met along the way, which is the title of one of the chapters, and people along the road, and try to figure out what would have been the local circumstances which would have made it possible for these immigrant Jews to be successful, and most of them were relatively successful, to be successful in this very intimate kind of selling.
So maybe for our listeners who aren't familiar with this, could you give us a little background on the Great Jewish Migration?
Okay, so between the end of the 18th century into the early 20th, although one could actually say that it went on beyond beyond the 1920s, about 3.5-4 million Jews crossed some national boundary and set off to build new homes for themselves someplace other than the places where they had grown up and where their families lived. Now, there were a much larger number of Jews moved within their home regions or home countries or home empires from backwater provincial areas to the big cities. Yeah, that was an enormous migration, but I'm really not looking at them. And some number of these Jews also went from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, so Polish Jews going to France. Okay, or Russian Jews going to Germany. And I'm really not looking at them either, in as much as they went to places that knew Jews very well. I mean, these are places that had resident Jewish populations for centuries. So I'm looking at those people. And again, this was the enormous. We're talking again about 4 million Jews who crossed a national boundary and went to places where Jews had not lived before or where the Jewish communities were relatively new and in process of formation. Most of these involved some kind of ocean voyage, although Polish, Lithuanian Jews going to Sweden did not cross an ocean, but they still went to a place where nearly no Jews had ever lived before. So the migration followed, we could say, two large arcs. And on the one hand, it followed European colonization. So Jews going to North America, Central America, South America, the Caribbean, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, followed on the heels of the European expansion through colonialism into, you know, what is, you know, historically or conventionally referred to as the New World. Colonialism wasn't the only part of it. And so the other arc is that these Jews followed the spread of capitalism. And so regions of Europe, places like Ireland, Sweden, Scotland, so on, as they become more and more caught up, as these are regions that were previously relatively untouched by capitalism, where most people lived in relatively subsistence economies, in which they had lived with very low levels of material consumption. With the spread of capitalism in the from the middle of the 19th century onward, people began to have some cash, some coins jingling in their pockets, and the peddler made possible them finding something to spend it on. Another part of this, which again shows how global this was, places like the British Isles, Sweden, even Quebec, which is obviously a legacy of French colonialism, but from those places, again, Scandinavia, British Isles, Quebec, as lots and lots of their own young people began to emigrate, okay, mostly to the United States, people back home experienced a rise in their status of living, in their material or their economic conditions. Family members who had gone abroad were sending back remittances, and so that families in the Irish countryside or in parts of Sweden, parts of, you know, in rural Quebec, were getting money from their family members who had gone off to work in cotton mills in New England or on farms in the American Midwest. And so that money that was sent from migrating relatives now became transformed the societies in which they lived. So this very long answer that this great Jewish migration took place in the context of these kind of major global forces.
And it sounds actually like you're making an argument against the tendency to see Jewish migration as the result of persecution to some extent. Is that right?
Yes, I'd say completely right. And I think, you know, Jewish historians and Jewish communal rhetoric has way overstated the degree to which persecution was the engine that drove the migrations. And, you know, we can think about this, for example, in the context of the history, you know, which is the largest of all of these migrations, which is the great East European Jewish migration from parts of the, from basically the Tsarist Empire. And that migration is always described consistently as a response to the pogroms, which seem to be dated in the, by historians, always dated to 1881. And, you know, taking no account of, you know, first, that there were pogroms long before 1881. Secondly, that people left, Jews left parts of the Russian Empire where there were no pogroms, like Lithuania. And Lithuania was one of the largest senders of immigrants, certainly until the first decade of the 20th century. There were no pogroms in Lithuania, and Jews from places like Lithuania and other impoverished areas of the Russian Empire moved, in fact, to the Ukraine and Moldavia, which is where the pogroms took place. So, you know, in a sense, pogroms were not the the catalyst. And while they were brutal and shocking and certainly had to cause Jews to question their status and their future in Russian society or this, in the society of their empire, it can't be seen as the great catalytic force.
And so it seems like a very large proportion of these migrants ended up as peddlers. Do you have some? Is there any way to quantify that? Or
So there's no.
And why? And why peddling is really the more important question.
Okay.
Perhaps. Why do so many of them take part in peddling?
Right. So I mean, can't quantify at all, and you're really dependent on sporadic evidence here and there, and you know, some of it is pretty good in that local Jewish communities in the New World places. I kept surveys of one kind or tried to count how many are we and what are we doing. And so you get a certain amount of certain set of numbers that come out of that. But, you know, they're not particularly reliable. The bad numbers aggregated from all over the world make it very clear that it was there were times when it was and places where it was the most common occupation, and other times it was just a very important occupation. So why? Well, it wasn't disconnected from the Jewish involvement in commerce before migration. Right? So it was not an unknown way of making a living. Some parts of the world, of the old world, the Jews' old world, saw Jews peddling there. So Jews in Alsace peddled back home, and they peddle in Louisiana and Arkansas and Georgia. Bavarian Jews peddled, and so they peddled in Bavaria, and they peddled then in you know, Wisconsin and Illinois and so on. So same with Jews from Bohemia, Moravia, Lithuania. So this was familiar, but I think more important, peddling as an occupation was probably the fastest and surest route to learning or to acquiring the kinds of skills that one would need in the new society, language, exposure to the local culture. And it was also the surest, fastest way to make a to fulfill the goals of the migration, which in the end was earning enough money, saving enough money to be able to get on with life and to have a family and and become a merchant of one kind or another.
And in terms of logistics, how did peddling work? So somebody would arrive in a new place, and could they immediately become a peddler? How'd they get started?
Yes, that's a great question. So when they didn't just randomly go to new places. They went to places where they had some contact, some family member, information about somebody from their town who had gone there first and had gotten started. We never know who the very first was, and so we can't ask that question. But people didn't, Jews, like all other migrants, just didn't just ramble randomly, but they very much focused on particular destinations where they had connections. And so they show up, and there's a brother there, an uncle, a cousin, a townsperson, a friend of a friend of a friend. And, those individuals, there were some of those individuals who were already involved in some kind of retail establishment, particularly, what became the sort of Jews' métier was dry goods, okay, and fabric, needles, buttons, thread, cutlery, eyeglasses, watches, jewelry, lace, ribbons, all that kind of stuff, and that. Person, you know, again, the townsperson, the cousin, the uncle, the who was there, would outfit the peddler with his first bundle of goods, give him a route, okay, and every peddler had his own special route, and he was not really allowed to deviate and to encroach on somebody else's route, okay, and he would set off on Sunday to get to his kingdom, and they would use the word Hebrew, the Hebrew word Medina, their state. They had a list of customers, even though they could certainly acquire new customers on the route. But since they still sold on the installment plan, they would go to the same houses Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, collect what was owed to them from the previous week, and then in the process, hopefully get the customer to want to buy something else, which would then extend the amount of time that customer was indebted to them, and through which the peddler could make his living, make his small profit, really a hair's breadth kind of margin for the profit. And then every place these New World peddlers went, they would on the weekend return to the cousin, the brother, the uncle, the friend of the friend, whoever it was who was their wholesaler, who already was living in some kind of settled community. The peddler would come back to that person. The peddler would spend the weekend, Sabbath, in some kind of Jewish environment, because there were going to always be a number of peddlers all clustered. And then Saturday night, basically around the New World, the peddlers would repay their creditors. Okay? This is what I took so much and so much goods for you. Here's what I owe you. And then the peddler would replenish his pack and then get back out on the road again. So they had this, the logistics, the mechanics of it were that they had a weekly circuit. And in Ireland, they were actually called weekly men. And in parts of South America, they were known as semananics, okay, semana being the Spanish word for week, and vachers in some places in England, so again, showing that weekly circuit.
So within the network of peddlers, it sounds like that whole network was a Jewish economic network. And then were the customers all non-Jews?
Yes. So from the top to the bottom of the selling chain, it was Jews. Jewish peddlers got their goods from Jewish shopkeepers, who got theirs from Jewish wholesalers, who got theirs from Jewish peddler supply companies, who got those from larger supply companies, who got actually a good deal from Jewish manufacturers. Okay, and so the goods flowed that way, and the credit flowed that way. But the customers were all non-Jews, and so they were the only non-Jews in this entire kind of vertical chain.
Could you talk a little bit about then the interaction between the Jewish peddlers and their non-Jewish customers?
Yes. So, it would seem like it would be a really fraught situation and one that could lead to just a lot of unpleasantness. And certainly there were some people who didn't want any peddler to come to their house and would not answer the knock on the door or slam the door in their face. But in the main, from the testimony of peddlers and the testimony of their customers, from other more, shall we say, neutral type sources, it seems as though the customers were really happy to buy from the peddlers. For farm families, it may have relieved the loneliness. Before I go on and go on any further, the customers were all women. Yes, they sold. Okay. Putting they sold goods that would have been of interest to women. Okay, again, buttons, lace, mirrors, pictures, and picture frames for the wall, tablecloths, towels, sheets, pillowcases. So these were very much home-related items, and so the women may have finally been in farm families, isolated one from the other, very, very excited about having this person come across their threshold and relieve the loneliness. For many of the customers, it was the only way to get material goods. And, they came to aspire to a higher standard of material consumption. And they would say, why should I sleep on a pallet on the floor when I can have a sheet, sheets and blankets and pillowcases on a mattress? Or why can't I have a rug on my floor or pictures on my wall? So that, or wear glasses, I can see now. So that the customers were very happy, these women were very happy to have access to these goods. For some of the women, it was a way to avoid shopping at the store owned by the plantation owners or by the mine owners, the infamous company store. So the peddler comes into the house, and he has no relationship to the planter. He has no relationship to the mine owner. And he could sell goods at a much lower price, at a lower rate of interest. For African-American women, the peddlers were really very important because these were women who, if they went into town to a store, besides the indignity that they would face having to, for example, get off the sidewalk when a white person walks by, which is pretty graphic, that they would not be able, in a store, they couldn't try on clothes, they couldn't touch the merchandise to see how the fabric felt, or maybe take a necklace out of the case and hold it up to their to their bodies and see how it may have looked. The peddler is perfectly happy. The peddler comes into their house and he treats them like he would any other customer, because like any other customer, they have money to spend on these inexpensive but yet luxury items. So for African American women in the South, to have the peddler come was in a way, a route or a means of avoiding the shame and the anger and the humiliation that took place in town. And So they generally talk about having very positive interactions with the customers. There's one wonderful story where from the South, where a peddler knocks on the door, and a woman, Georgia was, and she, you know, opens the door and she looks at him and she says, "I don't let Yankees into my house." He said, "I'm not a Yankee, I'm a Jew." He said, "Oh, then you can come in." you know, we obviously have to take these with a certain grain of salt. I think that I'm feeling that, you know, I assess them as reasonably accurate. One way we know that they had pretty good relationships is that whenever there was political turmoil, usually launched by merchants, you know, local merchants, against the peddlers, the female customers stuck with their with the peddlers. They liked the peddlers, and there were all over the world cases where peddlers were murdered. They were not murdered because they were Jews, but they were murdered because they were unarmed men on the road with money and goods. So they're a pretty easy target for ruffians. And so when there were peddler murders, what was really striking is, for one thing, the society as a whole marshaled its resources to apprehend the criminal, you know, the guilty party, to bring them to justice, to try them, to punish them. And in the inquest, you know, the local people came up and said, you know, that this peddler was, you know, he was a really nice person. We've known him for 2 years. And they would point the finger at some of their, you know, neighbors. You know, it was the sons of so-and-so who did it. And so that they didn't view the Jewish immigrant peddler as somebody who was outside of, shall we say, their moral universe. And it's
funny because there could be this tendency to imagine peddling as an old-fashioned, old-world profession, but it actually sounds like the peddlers used peddling to incorporate themselves into a new society, but also that they were really agents of change and modernization in their destination places.
Absolutely. And so there's a wonderful memoir by an individual who was eventually the president of Columbia, South America. And he says, you know, in our town, no peasant ever owned a pair of shoes until the peddlers came. Until the Jewish peddlers came. And perhaps less direct kind of testimony, we, you know, get the sense that, you know, for these customers, this is their first access to these kinds of goods. And these are goods that we would certainly consider necessities, sheets and pillowcases, okay, towels. Okay, but for them, these were relatively new items. I was very struck by reading how Jewish peddlers in Cuba and Jamaica and, you know, other parts of the Caribbean sold neckties and suspenders and cloth handkerchiefs to the, you know, they said sell them to the wives of plantation workers. And so, I mean, here are people who lived, you know, probably in the lowest level of, you know, lowest material level, probably the greatest possibility of exploitation in their society. And they're saying, look, my husband deserves the right to wear a necktie. You know, certainly nothing you need. I think the relationship between the customers and the peddlers is, we can understand even more about how that went, in that the customers slept in the homes of, the peddlers slept in the homes of their customers. So at the end of the day, now not always, and sometimes they were forced to sleep, you know, on the ground, in a wagon, in a barn, and in an empty field, in a forest. But in the most part, you know, they would ask, you know, customer, the last customer of the day, may I lodge here for the night? And since they had this weekly circuit, they knew the people, and they worked it out that the last home of the day was the person who was kind of, you know, the one that they had the nicest relationship with. And so they you know, slept in their homes. They would eat at their tables. opportunity or the challenge, however you want to think of it, as of having conversations with their customers of became a great way to learn the language. Okay, okay, so here they are spending the night in a family that speaks Spanish, French, Swedish, whatever, you know, they have to learn how to communicate. And so in some of the peddler memoirs, they said, I agreed to give them an extra item, and they would teach me English or French. Or, so that, you know, if the customers despise them, and they wouldn't be letting them sleep in their homes. Okay, and
right.
Bringing them, in a sense, into the family circle.
So with all of this intimate interaction, then, there must have been conversations about religion and about relationships. I mean, even eating, I suppose, would have been problematic for Jewish peddlers in non-Jewish houses. So did they have to negotiate that somehow?
Absolutely. And so that I see as one of the most illuminating parts of the story is that... I mean, since their customers were all non-Jews, and basically they're all Christians, so that, you know, the peddler is confronted with a series of moments in time or within this one evening that they're sleeping there where the issue of religion comes up, and certainly food is first. And so the wife of the family, his main customer, they say, well, would you like to eat here? And the peddlers have to decide, am I going to eat it or not? It's obviously not kosher. And, okay, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. And there's no one, they had no one response. Different people responded differently. In many cases, they would say, you know, I can't eat that. And the housewife would ask the most obvious question, which is, why not? I mean, who is there who doesn't eat, you know, bacon or ham or pork chops or whatever? And so, well, my religion forbids it, which then leads to the next obvious question. Well, what religion is it that doesn't let you eat ham hocks or, you know, lard? And so I'm a Jew, and Jewish religion says that, you know, we may not eat this food. And rather than have that be a matter of controversy or insult, what, you're not going to eat my food, or what, you're a Jew, they'd say, okay, well, what can you eat? And so sometimes peddlers would leave a pot at the home of, you know, each one of those homes, and they would cook themselves, or the housewife would, you know, prepare something that they could eat. Other times, though, the peddler would just say, look, I'm just going to eat whatever is given to me. But there were other religious conversations that took place as well. Sometimes the family would ask, well, what does it mean that you're a Jew? Who are the Jews? What do they believe? In quite a few narratives from particularly South Africa, among the Afrikaner, who were great readers of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible, family would read the Bible together at night. One amazing memoir, he said that the boer, the Afrikaner farmer, would say, since you're one of the chosen people, would you read the Bible for us and tell us what it means to you? Peddlers in their memoirs and customers in their memoirs talked about seeing the Jewish peddler, the male, they're all men, praying in the morning and putting on his prayer shawl, putting on the leather tefillin on their their foreheads and on their around their arms. And what is this? And so this too became a kind of moment in time in which the peddlers and the customers met over the issue of religion.
There's a really remarkable story in chapter 3 about a peddler named nicknamed Holy Moses.
Yes.
Could you maybe speak about that?
Yes. So Holy Moses, he was peddling in the Dakotas, a Jewish man from Lithuania, and he had, you know, his clients, they all knew him. They knew he was very religious. And at one point, he was approached by several of the customers. And the customers were primarily German speakers, immigrants from Germany to as farmers to the Dakotas. And they approached him and they said, we don't have a minister, and we wonder if you would come and lead services in our congregation. And so this is a story told by his daughter. And again, we'll have to assume there's a certain amount of embellishment over this. And he goes for several weeks, several months to this a German congregation, and he led them in a discussion of the Torah portion of the week. And one can ponder this and ask, you know, the question, if he had not left Lithuania as a peddler, and if they had not left Lithuania or of Germany to go become farmers in America, would either have ever met the other? And, we see the kind of transformative impact of, one might say, the New World itself and the peddling as the vehicle that brought these people together.
Yeah, it seems like there's a real synergy or maybe even symbiosis between the Jewish peddlers and their non-Jewish customers. And given maybe that they were in their houses so often, were there ever romantic relationships that developed?
Absolutely. And so all over the world, we have stories of peddlers and women falling in love, getting married. In some cases, the women convert to Judaism. In other cases, the men end up in just lifelong relationships with the women whom they've met in the course of their study, their travels. They're selling expeditions. There is a wonderful comment by a man who's an official of the Alliance Israeli d'Universel. So this was a French Jewish organization heavily situated in the Ottoman Empire, and he went to the Amazon to check up on the young men from the particular area he had worked in who had gone off to be peddlers in the Amazon, and he said they spread their children all up and down the banks of the Amazon. And he says, and he was in a boat, and he said the little boy who was manning the boat or the raft said his name was Solomon. And he said, well, why do you have the name Solomon? He said, oh, my father's a Jew. And these relationships were, in a way, natural and normal. I mean, these were single men on their own, and they met, they fell in love, and again, it has a transformative impact on the Jews and on the places they went.
So it sounds like most of the relationships are very positive, but of course there is also some opposition to the peddlers. Does that mostly come from other business interests or local stores, or who's against the peddlers peddling in their areas?
Yeah, so the opposition to the peddlers come primarily from merchants who just see the peddlers as unfair competition, and they want them out. In some places, it's just a clear, uncomplicated economic tension without the religious or the ethnic or the national or whatever we want to call it, without the Jewish issue coming in. And partly we know this because there was opposition to other peddlers who weren't Jewish as well. And so there's the same kind of rhetoric and the same kind of political maneuvering against the so-called Yankee peddlers. That is, those are young men from New England who went peddling in the South and in the Midwest, Mid-Atlantic. And the same kinds of words were used against them as were used against the Jewish peddlers. But on the other hand, in a few places, it happened in Ireland, it happened in Quebec, it happened in a few spots in Latin America. Those places in particular, anti-peddler rhetoric sparked over into anti-Jewish rhetoric, which doesn't mean that the customers agreed with it, but local political, religious, businessmen came together and constructed an argument against the peddlers, which were not just that they were unfair competition, but that they were as Jews, alien to this environment and were corrupting the values, that they were the killers of Jesus, they were the parasites who fed upon the poor, and so on. But those were actually quite limited, and if you took the whole history, one might say, of anti-peddler rhetoric and anti-peddler political activity, the ones where the Jewish element crept into or flared into the arguments, pretty limited.
It also sounds like the peddlers are upsetting racial and gender norms, so I would imagine that also led to some opposition.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, and so in many places in the American South, for example, there's just a kind of fear that wherever the peddlers went, they were going to, because they're selling material goods to African Americans, material goods that in a way were at least on the surface in terms of, erasing some of the differences between being the privilege of being white and the degradation of being not white. And so if African-American can have the same household furnishings and the same necktie and the same jewelry, then it's erasing some of the sting of race, as it were, or the privileges of race. And so Jewish peddlers were often described as riling up the local African-Americans because of their the disruptive quality of the selling. In many places, the owners of the mines didn't like the idea that the peddlers were coming in and taking people away from the company store. And that's, disruptive of class relationships. And the issue of gender is that was kind of universal, and there was always the sly, snide, slightly humorous, sometimes not so humorous, notion that peddlers were seducing women and that they were kind of sexual predators. But I think we can see that as, again, more limited than the positive interactions, in as much as the peddlers, all of whom end up not being peddlers but becoming shopkeepers. And when they open their shops in the local area, they are considered to be respectable, upright citizens of a local community. People patronize their businesses. They occupy positions of respect. They might serve on a school board or on a road commission or a kind of local board of trade, whatever local honors were available, they would be able to acquire these. And so it shows that they garnered the respect of their neighbors, for the people to whom they'd sold.
So it sounds like then peddling is a temporary profession. Could you say a little bit about maybe how long one usually peddled? And I assume then that they stopped peddling because they were looking for better conditions with a more sedentary lifestyle.
Okay, so, nobody peddled because they wanted to. It was definitely not a kind of choice occupation. But they peddled because they saw it as the road to some kind of stability, some kind of greater comfort, economic viability. So it was not a lifetime occupation. It's really hard to know how long this was. If somebody did it a year, 2 years, 4 years, 3 years, since we can't calculate the number of people who actually peddled or the number of men who peddled, we can therefore not really calculate an average number that peddling went on. I'd say that, I got a lot of information from sources like obituaries. And, you know, it seemed to be, you know, 2-3 years was probably a kind of norm.
And while they were peddling, it sounds like they were single men, but once they settled down, did they incorporate into Jewish communities or other communities? And does that mean they also had the opportunity to get married and have children and things of that nature?
Yes. Yeah, so some of the, you know, particularly in the earlier period, the peddlers were single men. And then once they could open a shop was when they got married, and they had a variety of strategies to find a wife. Later on, by I think particularly as the focus of the source of the migration shifted to further in Eastern Europe as opposed to Central Europe, they tended to be as much, and also in the Ottoman Empire, they tended to be much more married men who would leave their wives and children back home. And then would send for them when when they had saved the money, or they may have brought them to the immigration, you know, to the destination country, but leave them in a big city. They leave them in New York City, and then the men might go out and peddle in the Adirondacks or in some other more remote area, see them once or twice a year, you know, maybe during Jewish holidays. There's almost a kind of a organic link between peddling and being on their own, stopping to peddle and forming a family, be it an existing one or getting married, becoming part of a Jewish community. Now, there were certainly any number of examples I ran across of men who were peddlers, got married, opened a store, and then actually continued to do some peddling, and their wives ran the store.
Hmm.
So that and that would often come to an end when they would have a child, and then it was now a kind of full family.
And some of these ex-peddlers become quite prominent, right? Am I right that, for example, Sears was started by an ex-peddler?
Sears, Julius Rosenwald, who's the president of Sears. His father was a peddler, so he's one generation removed. But I think some of the big names that we associate with, peddlers who really made it big were Guggenheim, Meyer Guggenheim, the Lehman, Strauss, Seligman. So these were people who became extremely, extremely wealthy and prominent, and all began as peddlers in America. The man founded the very fancy department store in San Francisco, I. Magnin. He was a married man in San Francisco, Jewish immigrant, and he was a picture frame maker and kind of a failure at it. And so his wife says, look at, you know, you're a failure. probably the only way you're going to make something of yourself is if you go out and peddle. And so he then goes peddles and saves the money, you know, makes the money, saves it, and, ends up founding this, you know, very classy department store.
And did peddling ever pass down to the second generation, or like in this case of Sears, is it something that the first generation does so that their children have a better life?
Yes. So definitely it's less than a one generation phenomenon. And sons never do it again. The sons never pick up their father's.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Hasia. I think we've taken up too much of your time. Just kind of curious, now that this project is done and it's an awesome book, everybody should go out and get it. I'm curious what you're working on now.
Okay, so in a way, it's not unrelated to your last question, which is I'm writing a short biography of Julius Rosenwald of Sears, whose father was a peddler. And this is for the Jewish Lives series at Yale University Press.
Great. That sounds like a great project. I look forward to reading it. Thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. And take care.
Okie doke. Thanks so much.